Classic Business with Michael Avery, sponsored by Alex Forbes, for insight, advice, and impact.
Well, as we edge towards the end of this year, markets are somehow sitting near all-time highs despite a year of tariffs, of geopolitical tremors, an AI boom that has half the world excited and the other half yelling bubble. To help us make sense of it all, I'm joined now by Dion Gous, Chief Investment Officer at Credo in London, someone who always brings a cool head and a long lens to the noise. Dion, great to have you with us, especially from London, where I imagine the mulled wine is out and the markets are, well, still simmering, shall we say. Now, as we stare down the last weeks of the year, it does feel like the perfect moment to zoom out a little. It's been a year of, you know, Trump's tariff theatrics. We had Liberation Day, followed almost paradoxically by a very strong recovery, extraordinary equity performance on the JSE, you know, in dollar terms, up almost 60%. And then the continuation of this AI theme, all against a backdrop of central banks easing again. How do you tell the story of this year?
Yes, thank you, Michael. It has indeed been an interesting year. I think if you just look at the summary numbers, it's quite unbelievable. We're sitting at a point in time where the S&P, for example, the world's largest index, all America's largest companies, is up something like 13 or 14% for the calendar year to date, depending on what time of the day that you're checking. But under the hood, it's been a lot more volatile than that. You know, we had a huge drawdown of more than 20% at the end of March, beginning of April. You mentioned Liberation Day, all linked to that. And then this amazing recovery. So yes, markets have been benign, but it's very much been led by the big tech companies, by the same magnificent seven, so-called biggest seven tech companies in the world, the same companies that gave us the action in the previous couple of years, and they've pulled indices up, some more than others. I mean, people may forget that companies like Meta and Tesla for the year to date are paltry single figure returns, you know, mid single digits. But then some of the others, Microsoft is of note, Amazon as well, they've both given us like in excess of 40% for the year. So it's been a tremendous year in terms of being rewarding for international equity shareholders. And it ultimately led to this phase in the market where, as you said in your introduction, you know, half the people are shouting bubble and the others are still quite exuberant by developments around us in AI space.
Yeah, and I think that tees it up quite nicely ahead of NVIDIA's results in a few hours' time in the US, because there is this divide and there's a growing drumbeat that we're in bubble territory when it comes to tech and AI names. Michael Burry famously exiting the market with these kind of trademark doomsday warning that certainly hasn't calmed any nerves. You've made the argument that if it is a bubble, we're probably still early in the cycle. How do you square the hype with the fundamentals when it comes to AI?
Yes, I mean, I will never try and pretend that I know what's going to happen in the market tomorrow. But if I just stand back and I compare this phase of the market to what a lot of listeners would have lived through in 2000, 2001, you know, the famous tech bubble that burst spectacularly. I was a young analyst and portfolio manager in the market already at the time. And I think there are some important differences to note. Firstly, the really hyped companies at the time and some of the biggest market caps in the world weren't simply making money, and they were overvalued in terms of metrics that even at the time were screaming at most rational analysts. They were valued at 100 times or more of not earnings, because there were no earnings, 100 times turnover or sales.
Yeah.
If you fast forward 25 years to where we are today, the largest companies in the world are these magnificent seven. I mentioned Microsoft and Amazon before. You can add Alphabet and a few others. These are arguably the best companies that the world has ever seen. These are companies with amazing moats, companies that are extremely profitable, extremely cash generative. They are still growing profits by double-digit figures every year. And therefore, they should command premium valuations. But those premium valuations are not off the scale silly. They're just expensive. They're not bubble expensive. They're just expensive. You can argue there's a bubble in specific names, smaller companies, maybe in things like quantum computing and others. And some of these have come off 30, 40% just in the last couple of weeks. So yes, perhaps a bubble in some of the smaller stocks. But I think at a broad market level, I would argue that we're not quite in bubble territory. It is still early days in terms of this whole AI development.
And, you know, it's a good point, because a lot of people have been pointing to the record CapEx spend, but a lot of that CapEx is coming from that cash and earnings that these companies are generating. There is some new debt being raised, but it's not as if these companies are not highly cash generative in and of themselves. So it's interesting listening to you say that, Dion, and that might be what investors get wrong when they reach for the bubble label too quickly. Now, with NVIDIA reporting results in a few hours' time, I mean, we're talking about the largest company in the world. It breached $5 trillion in market cap a couple of weeks ago. It came back a little bit. What are your expectations about how this plays out?
Well, I think there are two aspects of that answer. I think that the first is actually quite simple, and I'll explain what I mean by that. The second is the one that matters more. The simple part is that NVIDIA may have very complicated technology, and they are very much the market leader in what they do with the production of GPUs, you know, that goes into every AI play in the world out there at scale. When it comes to the financial analysis, which is what we're talking about here in terms of what do we expect of the earnings, it's one of the simpler ones. Why? Because they're reporting after the market tonight. They're reporting a week or two after all their biggest clients have reported. And we know already the business that Microsoft and Alphabet and Amazon and Meta and everyone else has done with them, because they've told us not only the business they've done with them, but also the planned business over the next year, over the next 3 years. So you can crunch all those things in a spreadsheet, and it's going to be quite difficult for NVIDIA to surprise us with their numbers tonight, because the clever analysts have already done their spreadsheets, and you can argue the numbers are in the price. That's the easy part. So in a nutshell, I don't really think the numbers will surprise too much on the upside or the downside. The part that I think matters more is simply what Jensen Huang tells us in terms of prospects. Now, of course, what he tells us should be compatible with what Zuckerberg and Nadella and others have told us over the last few weeks. But he may have his own perspective on it, because he's got the inside knowledge about his own products, etc. So I think if there's a surprise, positive or negative, in terms of his pronouncements about the future, I think that's what's got potential to move the market.
If we look at the position that NVIDIA occupies, as you say, staggeringly difficult engineering, that's a pretty big moat. And so it charges, and the margins are there for all to see. Accordingly, surely at some stage you're going to attract, and you are already attracting, a wave of competition to try and do what NVIDIA does. Is it a question of time that NVIDIA has over the rest of the market that gives a holder of NVIDIA confidence that it can maintain this dominant position?
I think so. I think, you know, the reality is that all these big hyperscalers have announced their plans to literally spend trillions of dollars over the next few years in terms of their data centers, their GPUs, all the sort of capacity build. And I don't really see any disruptor arriving on the scene in time to, you know, to displace much of that. The big threat probably potentially in China, a market which I don't know enough about. We will all remember the DeepSeek moment and the scare that that gave the market in February this year. So if there's going to be a competitor that disrupts them and that ultimately challenges their margins, it may come out of China. But as I say, it's 9 months after the original DeepSeek moment, and there's not been too much else on that front.
Now, I think a lot of our listeners have very equity-heavy retirement portfolios. They've enjoyed a great year. For them, I think every headline about bubbles and corrections and kind of Burry-style warnings lands right in the gut. What's your message to the investor who sees international markets near all-time highs, hears some of the doom, and worries that they're about to get caught at the top?
Sure. You know, before I answer that, let me just say this. You know, nothing that I say should be interpreted as financial advice. I always need to introduce that disclaimer, and especially when people listen to the program and they have very different risk profiles.
Sure.
So, you know, some people may not be able to afford the risk, and therefore maybe it's a good time to take money off the table. Having said that, if you do have the capacity for risk, and if you do have the stomach when it comes to, you know, your personality, you've lived through drawdowns before, if you can afford the risk, and if you have long-term view, those are all very important sort of provisos, then as far as I'm concerned, I will always remain long-term bullish. You know, I look back at graphs of the international market over the last 100 years, and you basically see it going from bottom left to top right with a few squiggles in between. And, you know, in hindsight, every correction merely a blip, and every all-time high effectively a buying opportunity. So I will always be long-term bullish. I believe an equity portfolio is not just a collection of shares that you hope does better than something else tomorrow, next week, next month, but it's a piece of the world's best businesses, and you get the world's best entrepreneurs, the best creative minds, the hardest workers, the smartest managers working for you while you sleep. And from that perspective, as far as I'm concerned, I remain long-term bullish.
And the history is right there. I mean, there's a great book, The Age of the Optimists. I think it's Credit Suisse and someone else, over 100 years, to your point. That line does go diagonally from left to right up, and you zoom out and you don't even see the global financial crisis or Black Monday or any of those. That longer term perspective does, though, collide with one very real structural risk, isn't it? And that is, and we're seeing it in the gold price, the debasement trade. How does the developed world, highly indebted developed economies, we look at what's going on in Japan at the moment and how bond yields have reacted to their stimulus, how do they get out of this debt? And the only politically viable way seems inflation, so slowly inflating the debt burden away. Do you see that as a real risk?
It is a real risk to your money, but it's a real risk to your money, especially if you keep it in cash or if you put in things like, you know, bonds, which will never give you a real return. Government bonds, treasuries, call it what you like. So the debasement trade has very much been intact. There's a building consensus in that regard. And that is why you mentioned the gold price. That is why I think the gold price has done as well as it's done. That is why I think equity markets are at all-time highs, because yes, gold is a real asset, but a portfolio of pieces of businesses, that's also a real asset. That is why, you know, some people are still buying farmland or other forms of property. That's possibly why crypto has done well up until recently. Crypto is a totally different conversation. But the debasement trade effectively is exactly what you're saying, is governments can ultimately only inflate away, and that's going to attack every asset except for real assets.
So, I mean, that's broadly constructive then for risk assets, if not outright bullish, I think very constructive. Listening to you, there's a almost philosophical calm that comes through. So let me put it plain to you. You know, are you, you know, because I think many investors want the reassurance, are you long-term bullish? And how are you positioning, without saying that this is financial advice, but personally, how would you be positioning into 2026?
I'm always bullish, Michael, for the reasons that I've mentioned. But I think you can only be long-term bullish if you accept the fact that in the short term, you can look silly and you can be wrong. So I will never say that the market is probably going to be up next week, next month, even next year. Next year could be a 10% drawdown. We probably overdue a drawdown. Mm-hmm. Will it happen next year? Will it maybe happen the year after? The answer is unknowable. But if you're not looking at next year, if you're looking at a period of, let's say, 3 years plus, 5 years preferably, then I'm confident to say that if you buy a portfolio of good quality companies today, if you try and be careful not to overpay for most of them, if hopefully you don't make too many mistakes, and if you do focus on the long term, you are very likely to make money, not only in absolute terms, but in real terms from such a portfolio.
Dion, a great pleasure. Thank you very much. I think a very calm head while there's a lot of doom and gloom and noise out there about the day to day. It is all about having that long-term perspective. Appreciate the time.
Thank you very much.
Classic Business with Michael Avery, sponsored by Alex Forbes, for insight, advice, and impact.